You are listening to Class Dismissed, Episode 19, and I'm your host, Nick Ortigo. A librarian received a shipment of books from the First Lady of the United States, but she turned them down. Plus, if you belong to a teacher's union, there's an upcoming Supreme Court case that may impact you, and a whole lot more states are about to start paying a whole lot more attention to chronic absenteeism. Stay with us. Class Dismissed is the podcast that inspires educators through story. Each week, we cover some of the hottest topics and news in the world of education. Plus, we speak with a guest with a bright idea for education that you can apply in your community. This week, we're chatting with an educator that's pouring his heart and soul into his students' digital portfolios, and he'll tell us why that's so important. Hey everybody, Nick Ortigo here, and I'm joined with student data expert Russ Davis, of school status and teacher extraordinaire, Lissa Pruitt. Lissa, how are you doing?
I'm great.
Russ, how's it going on your end?
Going pretty good.
You know, I took your advice and I kicked off the, I don't mean to talk about the Ken Burns Vietnam thing again, but I watched the first episode and part of the second, and I think I'm hooked.
Yeah, it's one of the best series. I mean, it's kind of a high bar anyway, but like anything Ken Burns is going to be great, but I think this one is particularly good. And when you get in episode 3 or 4, you're really going to say like, wow, this is, because he deep dives into some of that stuff. That's just amazing.
Yeah. I just didn't realize how little I knew about the whole thing. And you know, even though my parents were alive and well during that time, I just, and I went to history class and I felt like I was a good history student. I feel clueless now. So.
Yeah. Well, I find it interesting. Like, I don't remember, I remember covering this kind of stuff, like in various histories that I took both in high school and in college. But I don't think the Vietnam War was very, like, how we got into it. Like, it was very enlightening for me. Either I didn't remember it, or I don't think it was ever covered, or wasn't covered in depth.
Well, and let's be honest, the people who taught us when we were going through it, like, they all went through it. And apparently, according to this documentary, it was almost something you didn't really talk about. So we're the kind of the lost information generation of Vietnam, arguably. I don't know. Might be overthinking it, but...
I think that Ken Burns is doing a good job, and it'll take a while to like once it like hits Netflix and all these other, you know.
It's still
watching?
It's still free.
Oh, is it?
I got
through
Apple TV on the PBS app, no charge. So
wow, that's really great.
If anyone wants to check it
because
out.
I saw it was on the Apple TV like store,
right?
As well.
That's
but
for
that's
the
really cool.
Yeah,
that's a pro tip there.
Well,
Nick.
What if you don't have Apple TV? How do you watch it?
I think you can watch it on their website.
Yeah, PBS.com, straight computer or yeah. So anyhow,
there is something to be said about like public broadcasting. Like that's really great that they picked that up and it wasn't some, you know, Netflix exclusive, or even though pretty much everyone has Netflix, but it's not like, you know what I mean? I think it's good for PBS to do that.
It's excellent. Well, listen, let's go ahead and kick off the Teacher's Lounge. What do you know? I think you're going to get a little political on us, are you not?
I mean, I guess so. I try to stay out of politics and all that, but geez Louise, I'm sure everybody has probably heard, if you're in the education areas, about the librarian in Massachusetts that refused 10 books from the First Lady. Yes.
So how did that go down?
Well, 50 schools were chosen across the nation by Mrs. Trump on a National Read a Book Day. So she basically sent 10 books to schools that she felt like were, you know, leaders in the reading, you know, almost like a good attaboy kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But they were rejected by this librarian who said, you know, basically, we don't need the books. I have a master's degree in library science, and our school is one of the top performing schools. And plus, these books that you sent were Dr. Seuss books, which is a bit tired and
a kinda
cliche.
She kind of took a shot at the choice of books, right?
Yes. And then she sent a list of 10 books that she felt like should be sent around. And of course, they were very, you know, opposing to some of the things coming down in education right now, you know.
It was a very selective list. So I guess what I'm thinking, everyone's probably listening to this and they're quickly, you know, coming up with their own opinions.
This is the first I've heard of it, by the way.
Okay,
what?
Good. So everyone's thinking their own opinions.
I swear.
What?
Like, I've been like locked in a cold, dark room for 2 weeks doing accountability appeal. So I apologize. So go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, no, but what once before we get to kind of what our own perspective is, what's been the general reaction to this librarian's move?
Well, as far as in her own school, which is Cambridgeport Elementary School in Massachusetts, there was immediately media on the scene that were interviewing parents and such, and they said, you know, we thought her letter was well written and well explained, and so, you know, good for her for, you know, it seems like she's trying to show the First Lady, hey, you have a lot of resources at your fingertips, so if you really want to make a difference, let's do it. Let's really make a difference, you know, because sending us some Dr. Seuss books in our, you know, library that has over 9,000, you know, books, that's not helping us. You know, that's one side. Now, the school was very quick to step up and say, whoa, we did not, you know, she does not have the right to refuse or accept or even use this as a political agenda.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was certainly, you know, now I have read into it a bunch just because the whole thing is shocking to me as a teacher. I do see where the librarian is saying, you know, wait, let's give books. If she was saying, hey, thank you for the books. I don't need these books, though, so I would like for you to give them to this school that has very few books and resources. You know, that's one thing, but there was definitely a bit of an agenda side to the published letter. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's definitely a lot of other people out there that are speaking out saying, okay, number one, that wasn't a gift to just you. That was a gift to your school, and your school was being recognized, and the children of that school would be excited to know, you know. And she did make a comment about Dr. Seuss's books having kind of a racial undertone, and so that has gotten a lot of attention. I will say, as an educator, the books that she did promote herself, the librarian's book list, was very controversial books, you know, some were really, you know, brave books of someone taking a stand or, you know, but a lot of them had to deal with some really tough topics to talk about with kindergartners. And so the letter that accompanied the Dr. Seuss books was about, you know, you have so much out there. My favorite book is Other Places You'll Go. There's so much out there. It all starts with learning to read. So make sure that's your first priority is learning to read. And so, of course, you're going to have early literacy books of the 10 books, you know. So, but the books that were on the list that the librarian suggested were much older books about, you know, being maybe homosexual and how to deal with it, or maybe having parents that are incarcerated and how to deal with that. You know, they were great books, but books that maybe would be more appropriate for someone older to deal with some tougher issues than just trying to learn how to read.
Yeah. Russ, what do you think?
I think the librarian made a mistake. Frankly, it's Dr. Seuss. Like, I get that I'm not up on the librarian scene, but not everything has to be a political statement. And while I'm not going to get political in this, but I think that it's the First Lady and she's giving your district or your school books, and you can have a personal opinion, but, you know, you're not the sole voice of that school. And frankly, I just don't have a problem with my kid reading The Cat in the Hat. We read The Cat in the Hat. If it's tired or not, like that's just critiquing. Yeah. Like if I sent them books and she sent them back, I'd be pretty angry. You know what I mean?
Like the letter said, like, hey, maybe you should ask so-and-so for a suggestion, because I bet she could give you some great resources. I mean, it was very, you know, kind of like,
nasty.
You silly girl, you don't know anything about.
Yeah, and I just, I think that there's an error. I read the letter. I read the First Lady's letter, and I read the librarian's letter. And I think one of them is way nastier than the other. Right. Maybe I'm just overreacting, but
no, I think
it's rude. You know what, frankly.
Right. Like, how about saying thank you? I mean, we all get gifts that we don't necessarily want it or need it.
I mean, how many times we regifted that? Regifted that? What is it? What do you get at Christmas?
Fruitcakes.
Yes. How many times has that fruitcake been regifted? Exactly.
Well, so, to me, you got to respect the office. And this reminds me of, if we roll the clock back, I'm guessing about 8 years or so. Do you remember when President Obama wanted to speak, do a video message to all the schools? And it kind of, I think Glenn Beck kind of kicked it off or whatever and just talked about, you know, they're indoctrinating.
Glenn Beck. There's a name I haven't heard
right,
in a while.
Exactly. He's going to be indoctrinating these kids and this is horrible and the president shouldn't speak to the kids. And it became so controversial throughout the country and in many states, including the one that I live in, many superintendents, some of which had to be elected, felt the pressure and did not play the video of the president who just wanted to speak pretty innocently right. to students. Right. And I kind of see it the same thing. It's like, it's a shame that, you know, so here you have two opposing parties. Just let the leader, they won, let them speak, let them send their message and just take it. You know, it's not that bad.
And here's the deal, Pickles. I remember growing up and I remember every first lady, me as going through school. Just Say No shirts. I remember, I remember Mrs. Bush and her whole, you know, push for literacy. Mm-hmm. Like, and I didn't know much growing up about one side or the other and their views. I didn't even know who my parents voted for because they refused to discuss that. They said, no, we don't discuss that. You know, it's our vote, whatever. So, but I grew up loving our nation because as a little girl, I loved the first lady. Mm-hmm. That's what I recall. That's what I call every first lady almost seems to always reach out to the younger generation, especially, you know, children in schools. And so it kind of, to me, like, let's keep all this other stuff out of it. At the end of the day, if there's a child in kindergarten or first grade that gets called to an assembly because the first lady of the United States sent their school out of the whole state, got 10 books. Like, that's exciting. That's motivating. That, you know, I think we all need to try to love our country more and be more united. And sometimes silly little things like this unite us. And then why do we do something to divide it?
You know, in the letter, it actually says, as I was thinking about your return to school, I wanted to send a special gift. Dr. Seuss's Oh, the Places You Will Go is a book my son and I have read over and over again and one that I want to share with you. Like, or we want to share with you. Remember, the key to achieving your dreams begins to learning to read. Find what you enjoy, anything that interests you, and read about it. Every page will take you on an exciting journey. I got to be honest, like, what is the matter with that? Like, that's fine. I think that the librarian overreacted, and I think that she's, she's a member of Librarians Without Borders. Obviously, she's probably a little sensitive about it and has, maybe has an agenda, but that's just my personal opinion. But I just think it's kind of, I don't know. I just think it's overblown. I think that it was an overreaction, and I think that they should accept the books and just move on.
Yeah, saying that.
Same.
Saying that, let's just go ahead and move on to the next topic, Russ, because I know you're tracking something that could affect teachers around the country, but it's coming down the pipeline, it looks like. Is that right?
Absolutely. There is a – so as you guys know, our Supreme Court now is fully stocked, so we have all the justices, and they're resuming a very full schedule. And one of the cases that they're considering, it's a case of Mark Janus, who was an Illinois state employee, and he is in a non-right-to-work state. So as a public employee, I believe he has to pay union dues if he is receiving the benefit of a collective bargaining agreement. And he basically is saying that he doesn't want to pay these dues, he doesn't agree with their position, and shouldn't be forced to. And this has some pretty large, so there are 28 states that are right-to-work states, which basically right-to-work means that you have laws that forbid workers, forbid requiring workers to support or join a union. And so if you're not in a right-to-work state, then in order to be a pipe fitter or to be sometimes a school teacher or to be a just a state employee, then you have to be a member of a union and you have to support them in your dues. In fact, these dues come directly out of your paycheck in some cases. And so as you know, that the NEA, the AFT, Service Employees International, American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, they're all, you know, unions. And so essentially, if this is struck down or if they agree with the Mr. Janus, then they could very well set aside the requirement that you have to pay your dues.
So what does that mean for a teacher, essentially? Like, what would that
mean to unions? Well, it means that I think what it means, and again, I'm not a legal scholar, and there's a blog called SCOTUS Blog. It's at SCOTUSblog.com that has much more in-depth discussions about this case. But essentially, the implications for teachers are as follows. Essentially, if this goes forward, meaning if they agree with Mr. Janus, then you can not be forced to pay your dues. Even though that the union could be collectively bargaining for you if you do not agree with them. And I think that has some merit, right? I think that there are both sides of the case, but I think that there is some merit in saying, hey, I disagree with the AFT, or I disagree with, you know, these other unions, and therefore I don't want to support them and I shouldn't be forced to. And I think that's his argument. So I think that they have the potential to not require that folks pay their dues, and therefore this could really hurt these unions because unions are funded by dues.
This really could be a death blow to unions, the way I'm hearing it.
It could be a significant blow to the unions.
And we already know pretty much how the court sits on this, because early last year, there was a vote, and it would happen to be right after Anton Scalia died, and the vote was 4-4 on a similar but different case. So here it is coming back up again this year, and you now have Neil Gorsuch on the panel. And so one could assume if the numbers kind of go the same way, Gorsuch would, of course.
Yeah, you know, I would say let's reserve judgment on, of course, you know, I think a lot of people are going to say like, Gorsuch is a sure thing. And he may very well be. But that's also what they said about Roberts during the healthcare debate.
That's
and he
true.
Surprised the heck out of everybody. So
right.
I think that, you know,
and each
it's a matter
is different.
Of. It is. It is completely different. And I think it's a matter of law, right? But definitely, whenever they took that vote, and certainly Alito has opined in the past that, you know, the First Amendment means that you shouldn't have to support something that you don't want to. And I think that there are people that legitimately feel like, hey, I shouldn't have to pay the $44 a month, you know, to support the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. Obviously, Mark Janus feels that way, right? There are a lot of teachers across the United States, and probably listen to this podcast, that are either voluntarily members of AFT or NEA, and the ones that are in non-right-to-work states. This will have implications. Either it will affirm the existing position, or it will affirm a counter position, which would be a huge pivotal change for unions in the United States, not just in education, but everywhere.
Lissa, what about you? Were you ever or know anybody?
Yeah. And I do think a lot of teachers, and I think it varies state to state, like you've said, depending on what their laws are. But I do think a lot of teachers sometimes feel a little lost in this whole union thing, like, you know, kind of like it's so big and the individual teacher is so small that sometimes some of the issues that one is supporting over the other, you greatly agree with, but then there's a few other issues that you're like, oh, no. Yeah. And so it's kind of like, it's almost like what some
like
people,
political parties.
I think, I think it's what some people go through when they're trying to pick a party, because they're like, well, wait, but on this issue, I feel this way. But on this issue, I feel this way. And so it is kind of frustrating, I can see, where, you know, to be required to support something that you don't 100% support. You know, it's probably like they're like, well, I'll give you $5 because I agree with this thing, this one thing.
I think folks really have to determine, is this a good thing? Like if they reject it, I think they'll have to determine, is this a good thing for me? You know, like, is it a good thing to have these guys collectively bargaining on my behalf, even though I may not agree with everything they say?
Right.
You know, and I think a lot of the times the country is growing more dichotomous. Like, I have to agree with 100% of what you say in order to support you. You know what I mean? Which is a foreign concept. Mm-hmm. This hasn't always been the way that this country has seen things. Typically, you know, folks agreed on some things and disagreed on other things and kind of met in the middle. And now I think just politically, I think we're becoming way more divided in that it has to be, I have to find someone who I agree with 100% of the time in order to support them. And, you know, there are times when, you know, when folks are correct, and there are sometimes when folks aren't correct. And I think you just have to decide, are these guys doing the best good that they can?
Yeah.
For me.
Yeah. So, Russ, I've got one that I want to kind of pick your brain on.
Sure.
I was reading on NPR Ed about how and we've talked briefly about this in past shows way back when, but more states are about to use student absences to measure school success. And really what it all comes down to is a new federal education law that...
ESSA, yeah.
Yeah, and they're actually asking schools to measure on, I think, five different areas, and most of those are going to be academically related, but then there's a fifth one that's kind of a wild card, and it looks like 36 states and the District of Columbia are going to make that fifth one dealing with chronic student absenteeism. And I know you guys have a lot of experience kind of tracking that. Is this the right way to go? Is this hard to do for a district? Kind of, what does this mean?
I don't think it's hard to do for a district. And frankly, I think it's the right, it is the right way to go in that it is quantifiable and research has generally proven that this is the case, that if students are chronically absent, and the definition of chronically absent varies, I believe the feds are issuing what's called non-regulatory guidance. Now, please don't fall asleep as I'm saying this.
Okay.
But they're issuing what's called non-regulatory guidance. So, you know, not to bring you through like the schoolhouse rock on how a bill becomes a law, but once a bill becomes a law, it is up to the agency, the federal agency, to interpret those, mm-hmm. the intent of the law, and to issue what's called non-regulatory guidance. And so non-regulatory guidance essentially is... basically, here is a law that Congress laid out, and here are the rules that we are putting in place to enact that law, because Congress can't, you know, can't get into the minutia of every single little thing. So here's how we're interpreting it, and it's largely a political decision. It obviously, the Secretary of Education is a political appointee, so it is a political decision. But anyway, once that comes out, it will determine, you know, what is the percentage. But usually, or generally, the definition is greater than 10% absence for that student. So in a 180-day school year, it would be 180 days. In a 90-day school year, excuse me, it would be 18 days, I beg your pardon. And in a 90-day school year or class, it would be 9 days. So I think, you know, anybody that misses 18 days in a school year, I would say they're truant, right?
Yeah, right?
And in most states, they would have already intervened by that point and turned them over to the local court as a truant. But those students do not do well, generally speaking. So it greatly affects even students that they test, you know, that they account for their past performance. Like absenteeism directly affects a student's ability to succeed. So I think it's not a bad idea at all. Obviously, we deal with this on a daily basis. Some of the metrics that we track, one of them, obviously, is student attendance.
Yeah, and don't you guys, like, take the data and email it to superintendents daily or weekly or something?
We do. We send what's called a daily digest, and we tell them, like, what their average daily attendance is. And if it's factored into their state funding formula, we also tell them, you know, how much money they're losing on a daily basis if they use ADA as one of their measures. Mm-hmm. One of the measures that we are adding is the number of students who are chronically or persistently absent by school as well, so that we can tell folks, you know, here's the percentage of the population that is chronically truant or persistently truant. And also, here are the students that are trending that way, right? If you've missed 15 days, like a lot of the times in education, we have a waiting to fail methodology. So we wait for them to cross some benchmark of failure. So that 18 days or that 10% mark for absenteeism. Mm-hmm. And so we like to tell folks when they're trending that way.
Yeah,
so
be proactive.
If it's halfway through the year and you miss this many days, then if they continue to repeat that performance throughout the year, then they'll have this many days and you should be looking at them. And more importantly, you should actually do something. You should call the parents and not just say, hey, I think it's important that your child, like, you shouldn't just say, hey, your child is missing school and that's bad, right? I think parents know that.
Drugs are buying.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. And so they,
you did it better than me.
So they, essentially, they should call and say, I'm concerned about Johnny's performance. I want him to be successful in life, and going to school is a great way to ensure that. It's important that he's here every single day because we cover important material every single day. And it's also important that schools do just that. Like, if, you know, kids are watching movies or something like that, or they have some sort of long-term sub, and they're not, the students don't feel like they're getting that, and they're coming back home and they're telling folks that, then it could be that, you know, maybe that they just don't feel like it's important, or, you know, it's towards the end of the year and, you know, that kind of thing.
Listen, so what's the expectation of a teacher when you start realizing a student is on track for chronic absenteeism? Do you like have to flag the administrator? Do you contact the parent? Like, how does that work?
I contact the parent because usually their grades are slipping also, you know, because, and even though they have lots of doctor's excuses and things like that, and there may be legitimate, you know, definitely like, you know, someone passed away and then there was already a planned vacation and then flu.
Then we went
and,
to Disney World.
Right. So things like that happen. Absolutely. But, you know, especially in math, you know, you'll start to see that they're like, what are y'all doing? Like, wait,
well,
how did you know to do that? Like, they are so confused.
Go.
And so usually, yeah, you do. I mean, I think any great teacher is going to make contact and just say, you know, either, I mean, I have offered to meet a child at recess, you know, to be able to catch them up, because when you miss that much, I mean, you're really behind. I mean, it's hard to miss one day. Anybody, any parent out there that has a child that has missed a day or two, you know, you'll hear them say, it wasn't worth it. It wasn't worth it for us to even miss 2 days because it's so much work to catch up.
Yeah, we missed one day for the solar eclipse, and I felt like we paid for it.
If you miss a week of algebra, you're screwed. You're way behind. Like, and you're going to need the knowledge that you gained the week before.
Right.
In order to know what to do the next week. And geometry is very much like that too. Like if you start screwing up and missing geometry or trig or something like that, like those classes are, first of all, it's going to be really tough to read the textbook and determine what the heck is going on. Because a lot of it's lecture based and showing stuff on the board and
you can't look at it
on the whiteboard.
Figure it out. And parents can't help their children. As your children get older, you start to learn, oh gosh, okay, go to school because I can't help when you come home. You know, like that happens. Like,
yeah, no, math, no way. Hey, are y'all ready for the bright idea?
Yeah.
I am. Let's do it.
All right. Our guest in today's Bright Idea segment is aggressively leading the way in his school district when it comes to digital portfolios. Daniel Witt is the instructional technology coordinator at Madison City Schools in Madison, Alabama, and he recently wrote a great piece on EdSurge.com about making digital portfolios a priority for students. Daniel, thank you so much for being on the show.
It's my pleasure, Nick. Thanks for having me.
You know, before we dig into the finite details on digital portfolios, I want you to help me kind of draw a picture for listeners on what exactly a digital portfolio is like in your school district.
Well, digital portfolios, big picture, can be a variety of things. What we've really sought to do here in Madison is create an idea of what a digital portfolio is that is applicable all the way from kindergarten all the way up through graduation. So though the tools and the formatting and things like that may change, the basic concept for all students is practicing constant show, then reflect. That's kind of our mantra. And if you watch the portfolio documentary we released earlier this year, that's a big part of what we're talking about. So it's the idea of having a showcase place or a place where students can curate their work, their successes, their failures, the things they care about, some of their classwork, things like that, but do a lot more than just show. So we think that a major area of deficiency in public education is reflection. And so one of the biggest things we're attempting to prioritize with this movement is making a space purposefully for reflection in the daily lives of our kids.
And so that space, the way I kind of see it and kind of going through your documentary, which we'll link to in the show notes, it's on YouTube, but the space is a website, essentially. Is that what you guys are setting up these students with?
Yeah, I think by the time kids get into the secondary grades, for us that means 7 through 12 right now. By the time they get there, I think they need to be exploring, you know, website design. And there's so many tools out there and so many of them are free that not doing it is, in my opinion, a major disservice to kids. So yeah, by the time they get there, that's kind of what they should be thinking, whether they're using Google Sites or Weebly or something like that, or going a little bit more sophisticated with something like Wix. And some of our most advanced kids in high school especially are using things like Adobe's Dreamweaver to build it from scratch, which is really amazing. But in the earlier grades, you know, we think of it more as something like Seesaw, which is a fantastic platform for showing and reflecting and creating a parent engagement triangle between the kid, the parent, and the teacher. And then Class Dojo, things of that nature. So the idea is to scale this down into elementary, you often have to sort of abandon the idea of web design, especially for K through two, and sort of replace it with usually a touchscreen friendly app of some sort.
So these kids are doing something incredible in their school, and the idea is to take those projects that they're doing, whether it be part of a play or an art project or writing, and then put it on a platform so parents, teachers, anybody can take a look at it, right?
That's exactly right. I mean, the idea here is to showcase things that are not easily quantified, right? So if I am a third grade student and I have been working for the last 3 weeks in one of my special classes or electives on building a rocket out of cardboard and duct tape, then I take photos along the way and I sort of curate images into the journey, the learning journey along the way. And maybe I put all of those photos in and I write a one or two sentence reflection under each photo to show my progress, not just the progress of the rocket, but my emotional process, my learning process as a human being, and what it felt like to fail the first time and things of that nature.
What happens during that reflection process? Do you believe that more learning is taking place there?
Yeah, I would venture to say that I know that more learning is happening there. You know, I don't think it's rocket science. I think for me as an adult, I'm now in my upper 30s, and now looking back in my school experience, the things that are memorable to me, the things that meant the most to me, often included failure and often included opportunities for me to discuss in some sort of dialogue format, what type of experience I had. And so if we can create a platform and carve out purposeful time day to day in public school and prioritize that reflection time, we know that more learning is going to take place.
From reading the article that you contributed to edsurge.com, it's you sounded a little bit like a squeaky wheel in that regard of what you were just saying, which is, you believe that a digital portfolio and these reflections is something that all school districts should really be embracing. And I think you said a quote, it's crucial that we approach a digital portfolio not just as another thing, but as both a vehicle and the fuel to approach the future of education.
So first I will reference one of my favorite thinkers alive in education right now, and that's Mark Prinsky. I quoted him, I think, at least once in the article, but his thinking has really shaped a lot of my thinking. He believes, as do I, that the future of education is a new birth of two already existing formats. So if you think of like the pre-industrial time, education essentially was apprenticeships. It was people pairing up with mentors as an apprentice, learning a skill or a trade, and then constantly failing, succeeding until they became a master of some sort in whatever category or categories they were pursuing. And then once the Industrial Revolution sort of reinvented our expectations for school, we standardized our expectations of all students. And so everyone's learning the same thing, everyone's shooting for the same learning targets, the same goals, and so forth. And in my opinion, what we basically need to imagine in our minds is that sort of agrarian idea, pre-industrial, and then the post-industrial, which we're in now. And imagine if the two of them got together and had a baby, then that is going to birth something new, a new way of learning, a new way of thinking about education. We're as progressive as we can be, right? Mm-hmm. There are a lot of things holding us back that are not related to this school district. We are slave to a game, and the game must be played. And the game by that is, here in Madison, we are one of the most successful school districts in the state.
Right.
And on all traditional metrics, whether it's PSAT scores, ACT, STAR data, all of that stuff, we're always in the top five. And so it creates this environment between the parents and the leadership and the larger community, and even the students are part of this too. It creates an environment where there's sometimes very little impetus for change. So if you're already at the top of all traditional lists, why would you change much? And I think that's a common theme throughout the United States for successful school districts. So that's one problem. Now, in districts with high poverty, what they're stuck in is a cycle of lowered expectations. They have a little less to lose, though, and I think that there's a way to actually take those districts and make portfolios the thing that drive the change, because they do have an impetus for change, but the expectations have been lowered culturally over time. So if we can transform the way they think about learning by including digital portfolios in their day-to-day lives, I think we stand a chance of really igniting a fire, and it would be a lot easier to measure the progress in those districts than it would be in highly successful districts.
So you guys, Madison City Schools really seems to be leading the way from what I've seen with these digital portfolios. Have you had a chance, or has your leadership hasn't had a chance to go to a conference and maybe present what you guys are doing and kind of get some feedback on if other districts are doing something similar?
Yeah, we've been to a variety of things. We've been to a few things. I go to things a lot. I have a team here. We work together. I have a lot of partners, both at central office and then in every school. We have 11 schools, and in all 11 schools, I have at least one or two people who have partnered with me on this. Some combination of our team has been to many, many conferences. And of course, we've also been, in this case, in a podcast, or we've written things for EdSurge or ASCD, things like that. And what we find is that a lot of people are talking about digital portfolios, a whole lot of people. In fact, I would venture to say that every district in some way is talking about them. The problem is there is no, at least prior to last year, there was no unifying vision. There was no mission statement for them. Right. And there was no deeper philosophical understanding that could drive leadership and politicians to wrap their brain around why we should prioritize them in school. So we know that everyone's talking about them, and we know that tons and tons of teachers are wise enough to want to prioritize them, but it's hard to get that momentum and get over that initial moment of inertia when politicians and parents and others are not on board philosophically. So that kind of segues into why we created the digital portfolio documentary and the Google Drive folder full of resources.
Yeah, you give people the tools to do this, right?
Yeah, we're really trying to. I mean, and to me, the tools are just as much a drive folder full of docs and sheets and slideshows and handouts and graphic organizers. It's just as much that as it is a video that tries to, at least in some ways, appeal to the emotional side of people. I think there is a much larger human story underneath digital portfolios. And it's not just logistics. It's not just let's carve out 30 minutes a day or let's carve out 2 hours on Friday. It's more about let's carve out new categories in our brains. Let's actually build new purposes for school in our minds. And I think that's the larger movement that I'm trying to push right now, because the tools now exist. So now it's about transforming the mindset of those who can actually instigate change.
What does a digital portfolio look like for a senior in your district who's done it right?
So there are a few sort of exemplars that we show. And if you link out, you'll see it in the Google Drive folder. There's a file in there that says Read Me First, and in there we have links to some exemplars. A senior who's graduating high school has a really deep and thoughtful website that they can share readily, that's published to the web, that is Google searchable. That's another thing we're trying to do with portfolios is basically we're trying to get a better digital footprint for our kids. Mm-hmm. If the first 10 or 20 Google results when that name gets Googled is positive content,
right,
especially positive content that's linked to a really well-curated digital portfolio, no one's ever going to dig deeper. No one's ever going to look at page 17 of the Google results to see that mistake a kid made on Twitter one time. There's always an About Me page or something like it, and we highly encourage our students to shoot a simple video of themselves talking about their reflecting on their high school experience or what it meant to grow up in their hometown or whatever, and then really communicating openly, verbally, on camera about what your expectations for your own future are, so that whoever's making a decision about you, about hiring you, or about giving you a scholarship actually has an idea of who you are, not just how you compare to the norm and things like that.
I'm going to link to y'all's informational site where you have this Google Drive and everything, but is there a direct link that you want to give people if they want to kind of look more into this?
Usually the link that we hand out is tinyurl.com/digitalportfolios-wholestory. That link will take you directly to the Google Drive folder. And that's kind of the shareable link. And we have that on business cards and we hand them out everywhere we go. But inside that Google Drive folder, the most important thing that you do is check out the Read Me First doc that's in there. And it'll link to the YouTube documentary and it will link to exemplars and all sorts of things.
All right, Daniel. Well, we appreciate you sharing everything you guys have on digital portfolios. Are you ready for our pop quiz?
Let's go.
All right, first question. If students could only go to school for one subject, which subject should it be?
Ooh, that's tough. I don't know that that subject exists yet, and I would like to build it. To me, it's future studies. That's something that's really on my mind. I'm obsessed with Alvin Toffler's work around the idea of future shock. And I know for a fact that we live in a time right now where we can't even predict tomorrow, much less 5 years from now. And in my opinion, we need to build a new class in school called Future Studies, in which students learn over time how to adapt and speculate.
Oh, good. That is one of probably the most unique answer I've had for that question.
Cool.
What are we not teaching in school that we should be teaching?
Ooh, please refer to answer number one.
Got it. What does every child deserve?
Every child deserves to have someone that they trust in the building that can be a point of contact for them outside of academics. Every student deserves to have someone that they can trust and go to have conversations about growth, about failures, about insecurities. And I think that Madison City Schools is definitely attempting to work on that problem. And there's a whole bunch of different solutions out there and combinations of solutions. But that's what all students deserve.
What's the biggest challenge for today's educators?
The biggest challenge for today's educators is force-fitting a traditional culture of education into a society that no longer values the exact same things from that traditional system. I think the average educator today knows good and well that their students live in a different world, and I know some great thinkers who would disagree with me on that, but the biggest problem is that teachers are attempting to lead their classroom environment and in their classroom learning cultures into the future, but they're doing it backwards. They're walking backwards into the future is what I always say. And they're sort of a slave to that traditional mindset. And so they're constantly negotiating with themselves and with their school systems.
What's the best gift to give an educator?
Time. I think, and I talk about this in my EdSurge article a lot, but we've got to subtract some stuff from our teachers' days. We can't keep stacking new things on top of them every single year, every semester, and sometimes every week. We have to learn to free them up, because out of that freedom is born innovation. And without that freedom, without that extra time built in, they're never going to innovate. They're always going to be slaves to the current expectation set.
What teacher changed your life?
I've got a couple, but the first one that comes to mind, man, I'm glad you asked that. I haven't thought about him in quite a while. His name was Mike Jones, and he taught a gifted class, 6th, 7th, and 8th grade for me, so all throughout middle school. And the reason he sticks out in my mind is because he let me be me. He let me be the weirdo adolescent boy that I was. And he had much higher expectations for me than the majority of my other teachers. And he accepted work that was outside the norm. He didn't want standard responses. And so I never felt compelled to give those to him. And it forced me into a situation where I had to put my money where my mouth was. When I say I'm unique, here's my proof. And he allowed me to turn in work that looked different and sounded different than other students. And that was very encouraging to me as an adolescent.
Yeah, good stuff. Last question, pen or pencil?
Pen or pencil?
That's it.
I'm a pen guy, man. I commit to stuff. And as techie as I am, as digital as I am, I love, as an audio engineer, I love recording to analog tape. Because I like to have ideas, articulate them, and then commit to them in pen so that I can't erase.
All right. Daniel Witt, Instructional Technology Coordinator for Madison City Schools. We appreciate you taking the time to kind of fill us in on all the great stuff you guys are doing over there.
It's my pleasure, Nick. Thanks again for having me.
All right. Take care.
That's going to do it for episode 19 of Class Dismissed. We want to hear from you, so if you want to send us an idea or comment, remember that you can always email us at info@classdismissedpodcast.com. We're here to support educators, but we need your support as well. So if you like what you heard today, please be sure and subscribe to the show, and we'd also love it if you leave us a 5-star review. Don't forget you can connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/classdismissedpodcast or on Twitter. Just search for us by typing in Class Dismiss. On behalf of Russ with School Status and Lissa representing all the teachers out there, I'm Nick Ortego, and I'll talk with you next week.
Class Dismissed.